This is Roy Bailey, interviewed at Bass HQ, Cambridge, by Chris Eldon Lee on the 4th of July 2009. Roy Bailey.
Born in Longfield in Kent, 10th of March 1922.
And your name is?
Roy Bailey. Roy Bailey.
Roy Bailey?
Yes. Okay. It's commonly known as Bill.
I see.
Okay. On account of presumably the song, Why Don't You Come Home, Bill Bailey.
So now you are 80?
Well, 80, what's it, 87.
87. Congratulations.
Well, nothing to do with me. Just a question of getting some useful ancestors, perhaps. I don't know.
What were you doing before you got involved with the Antarctic?
Well, I was working at Radio Research Station Slough, and developing ionospheric measuring equipment. And during the war, the Admiralty set up a number of ionospheric stations around various places in the Antarctic and various parts of the world, indeed. And there was certainly one went down to Port Stanley. Now, the Radio Research Station was coordinating observations with a view to predicting ionospheric propagation conditions. So when the Admiralty gave it up, they decided, the powers that be of the Radio Research, or the Radio Research Board probably, decided they would like to continue the observations from there, because there was, I think, only one other ionospheric observation in the Southern Hemisphere at the time. I think it was in Australia. So they were quite keen to carry on measuring it. And since I'd been developing hardware for it, they decided that I was perhaps useful to go, and I was willing to go, and in fact quite intrigued with the possibility.
Was this fairly new science in those days?
Well, I suppose it was in a way, because the knowledge of the ionosphere was fairly rudimentary, and Watson Watt, who invented radar, was working on the propagation of radio waves, noticed that aircraft reflected, and basically he went over to Badsey on the east coast, and that was the beginning of the whole of the radar chain. As far as the Radio Slough, so the work that I was involved in essentially was what amounted to the equivalent of a radar station. It sent a pulse up to the ionosphere, measured the delay, and as a function of frequency, and it produced a graph effectively which showed reflection from the E and F layers. And eventually you saw the echo apparently penetrating by having longer and longer delays until finally it didn't come back at all. And they were interested in relating that to using that sort of information and predictions of it to advise people like the BBC as to when they should change frequency, you know, for the... If they wanted to broadcast to India, they would obviously like to know what the chances of it reflecting at a particular frequency, and they could choose their frequencies insofar as they had any freedom to get the best results as far as they were concerned.
So it was important to know how the ionosphere was behaving.
Yes.
At various points around the globe.
Yeah, ideally, yes. Yeah. But it also depends on the time of day, season of the year, and state of the sunspot cycle. So it's a very messy sort of correlation with the whole thing.
But does the ionosphere always stick to the rules? Does it always behave in the same way?
Oh, no, you can get a variety of things. You can get I forgot what they call it now, a sudden burst of radiation from the sun, which can give a short-term complete blackout of or reflect destroys or I don't know whether I'd say use the destroyed upsets anyway the reflecting properties. It's a long time since I did any theory of what I never really did much theory on the nature of the ionosphere. As far as I was concerned, it was a layer somewhere up there. But I had to design a transmitter which would send a pulse up there and use a receiver at the other end to determine how long it took to come back, and then just change the transmitter frequency and the corresponding receiver. And that produced a graph. And towards the end of the time, the last thing I did for radio research Slough was to develop the thing that became known as the Beastie when it came down here.
How did it get the name?
I think mainly because it produced sufficient interference that it blotted out most of the radio communication within the immediate vicinity. I became very when I went out to Stanley and set up a station there, I was most unpopular because it went off most of the time once an hour, but sometimes every 15 minutes, and it took about 5 or 6 minutes, I think, if I remember rightly, to sweep over the whole frequency band. So it came through everybody's local receiver. It was a nasty raspberry sort of noise, and I wasn't popular.
But it was important work for military and domestic.
Yes, I suppose it was.
Uses,
yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, before the other thing, which is relevant, I think, was that before I went, my boss then, a man named Wilkins, said to me, "We'd rather like to know while you're in." In Stanley, we'd rather like to get some measurements further south. Would you make such inquiries as appropriate as you can as to whether it would be possible to make measurements further south? And I took that as being authority to have a look. Anyway, eventually. We were mentored by the Met Station, and Gordon Hawkins had been down in Antarctica anyway, knew a bit about it. And anyway, when the old wooden Bisco was coming down, I approached the governor of the Falklands and said, "Look, can I hitch a lift down?" Which he duly agreed to. And so I did, in fact, hitch a lift on the old wooden Bisco, which was going down to replenish, at that time, we thought, all the bases. And that was, from my point of view, ideal, because obviously to put in an ionospheric station, you need to put up some things called rhombic aerials, which require a fair bit of space. And so you needed really to have a look around the area as well as the actual base itself to see whether it was feasible to put up usually three 70-foot masts to hold up the aerials. Anyway, that's how I came to get onto the Bisco. And while I was when the Bisco came in, there was a radio operator who was going down to Lochroy, who had a personal interest in, you know, he was a radio ham.
This is George
Barry.
Barry, yes.
He was a radio ham who was interested in long-distance communication. And he heard we'd got a station up there, and he came up to just social visit to see what we were doing, and anyway, he was obviously quite keen on it. So I decided that we could probably raise enough equipment out of our supply of spares for Stanley to give him a pile of bits and pieces, including some old sort of RAF display units and other odds and ends. That I gave him effectively a box of, as far as I was concerned, more or less junk, and said to him, if you can take it down... Well, we gave him about probably a couple of hours instruction. I can't remember whether it was a couple of hours or even a day instruction, anyway, on actually making measurements, really only promising to measure a thing called the critical frequency. That's the highest frequency that doesn't bounce, it goes straight through the ionosphere. And in the simplest case, you just measure that frequency at noon as the most useful piece of information. And anyway, we gave him that amount of instruction. I gave him the pile of junk as far as I was concerned, and anyway, I'd approached the governor to see whether I could go down and have a look at possible sites for other stations, and he'd agreed. So with Bunny, I also was in touch with Bunny Fuchs, and he agreed to that I could come down on the old Bisco and have a look round, which was fine. We went down as far as Marguerite Bay. I didn't think we called in anywhere on the way down, because we heard that at that time, in addition to the Marguerite Bay FIDS base, there was also an American expedition in the city of Beaufort, was it? Another sister ship of the old wooden Bisco, that they'd allowed it to freeze in over the winter and had established a base there. Anyway, that had been iced in and wouldn't get out, so the Americans sent down a couple of naval icebreakers to get them out. And Ronnie Fuchs heard that they were going into Margaret Bay base, so we were somewhere about Deception at the time. He suddenly diverted us down to try and catch up with the icebreakers. And anyway, we went down, had an absolutely marvellous day just outside Margaret Bay, waiting for the icebreakers to turn up. And I had a most marvellous day on the masthead, crow's nest of the old Bisco. So it was one of those glorious days when the whole scenery was absolutely crystal clear. And it was one of the nicest days I remember, just sitting there, just looking at the... You could see a lot of the islands and... Anyway, the icebreakers turned up and took us in. It was the easiest base relief we had ever done, I think, because we were iced in. They just put up some planks, and so they just the year's stores, they were just slid down to the and somebody, I can't remember, I don't remember any dogs, but anyway, they were all duly hauled up to the top, up to the hut rather. Anyway, we didn't stay there very long, because I understood the fact that they'd broken a channel for the Bisco was strictly against the rules. I don't think they were. I think their formal instruction said they shouldn't interfere or have anything to do with the FIDS outfit. And I think the captain of the icebreaker took it upon himself to break us so that we could get in. Anyway, they obviously didn't want to hang about very long, so they eventually took us back out, and we headed back up north. Now, I was hoping to see all the base, so we called in at Argentine Islands and at Lockroy. Now, the plan at the time had been, I think on the way down they'd intended to go into Hope Bay, but the ice in Hope Bay didn't go out, so they went straight down, because of the icebreakers, they went down to Marguerite Bay. And on the way back, they called in at Lockroy. They dropped me there, and the theory then was that they would go up to Hope Bay, which was going to take about a fortnight. So I was dropped off with the thoughts that I could then help George Barry assemble the pile of junk that I'd left him, so that hopefully he'd be able to use it in some useful fashion. Anyway, the Bisco went off to Hope Bay in a typical Bisto fashion, developed engine trouble, and beetled back towards Stanley.
Leaving you stranded at Lockroy.
Leaving you stranded at Lockroy with the anticipation that I was stuck there for a year.
So what were your feelings at that point?
Oh, it was quite. It struck me as a rather nice idea. Anyway, I sent a cable to my boss in back at Radio Research, saying my return was somewhat delayed, having said that I was going down, without specifying whether it was going to be a week or a year. Mm. Anyway, say that as far as I was concerned, initially it looked as if it was going to be a year, and so it didn't really worry me at all. It was a bit tight because there were five of us and a four-man base, and we hadn't really completed the replenishing of
stores.
The stores. Mm. So five on a rather short ration. Oh, perhaps I should have said before that, at the time before the Bisco arrived, the Chileans and the Argentines were being a bit awkward. Lockroy was vacant, and there was a fear that that either Chileans or the Argentines would move in, and it would then have a sort of international incident if we tried to throw them out. So they sent HMS Snipe from the West Indian station down to retrieve the situation, or to stabilise the situation. It even suggested that we were sending over a heavy cruiser from Simonstown. I never discovered what they actually did, but certainly that was
the rumour.
That was the rumour. Anyway, when HMS Snipe came down, the governor picked up a couple of Falkland Islanders, Bill Richards, at that time an 18-year-old youth, John Blythe was the other man, and rushed them down to establish a presence at Lockroy, and then left them with about a fortnight's rations, which included, amongst other things, some yeast, which became important later. Anyway. In due course, the Fitzroy landed me, and Ken Pawson and Bill Richards at Lockroy as the permanent permanent staff. And left them, obviously, with appropriate stores, at least what they thought were appropriate stores.
And did you get to build your contraption?
Oh, yes, I built my contraption, and we did some... We took the first ionospheric measurements actually done in Antarctica.
And were you taking the measurements all summer or just for a few days?
To be honest, I can't remember. There'd no doubt be in George Barrett's report, in the Bass archives, I'm sure.
And did the equipment work fine?
Well, it worked. It was stuff that... I can't remember just when I just sort of... It was a valve equipment in those days. I think I've got probably one or two pictures of things assembled on a wooden... instead of any metal working, so it was made on a wooden chassis and just valve holders and just wired up.
How big would it be?
Oh, well, we had a conventional communication receiver, which was this sort of size, but the thing itself would be, again, that sort of size.
Like a large radiogram? Medium-sized
radiogram. Medium size. So I think I've probably got a photograph of it, if you want to see it.
And then that went out to the aerials, which were...
Yes, it went out.
And the signal was received by the same aerials, or...?
Yes, we might have had a pair of aerials, but they were on the same masts anyway.
Right. And so you were able to take measurements. You took measurements for over a period of time.
Yes, and I left it with George continuing to take some.
Right. So was that all you were doing at Port Lockroy, or were you also cooking and cleaning Rota as well?
I don't remember having much to do with... other than sort of going down to the shore and bringing back ice blocks for drinking water and that sort of thing.
Right. So you were a fit for a while?
Yes, I mean, I suppose you could call me a fit. A supernumerary fit, probably.
How were you relieved, Ray?
Well, eventually, the Bisco being out of action, they sent, because I think one of the reasons anyway was that Lockroy hadn't been fully resupplied. They sent the old Fitzroy down. Did you know the Fitzroy?
I've heard of it. Yes.
It was the little coastal steamer with, I think, 8-inch thick steel plates where they were rusted. Anyway, it came down and picked me up. I don't know whether have you come across Ken Porson's book about his time in the Antarctic? Ken Porson. He did a year at Lockroy and also a year at Admiralty Bay, I think it was. He's still alive and it's accessible in British Columbia.
Oh, right, okay. So you left the equipment running when you left Port Lockroy.
The only generators we had were two chore horses, which I think had been well and truly abused during they were very second hand, because in those days FIDS didn't have any organisation really to produce a decent generator, so we spent a lot of our time taking it to bits and
putting it back together again
to get it to fire up.
But you got results that were worthwhile.
Well, I hope so. Yeah.
And did you establish any other bases, or was Port Lockroy
That was the only base that
with the Beastie.
Well, that wasn't the Beastie. No, the Beastie was a later thing.
Right.
I built the original prototype of the Beastie before I went down, and it was then taken over by Union Radio, who made half a dozen, I think, which eventually became known as the Beastie.
Right. this was a little beastie that you took?
Well, yes, I suppose you could.
A wee beastie.
A wee beastie, yes. A crawling one.
Yes. And that was it, was it? Did you ever go down the Antarctic again?
I went down again in 2005 when the FIDS organised a trip down. I thoroughly enjoyed that. And unfortunately, I was very unlucky. I couldn't get into Lockroy. Mm-hmm. This was on the Polar Star. The Polar Star got into Lockroy. I was due to go ashore on the first Zodiac that was going ashore. Unfortunately, I was at that time using a stick, and I'd forgotten to bring it, and I missed the first Zodiac that was going ashore. But anyway, when they came back for the second Zodiac, they got a nasty diabetic gale coming down off the hill, and though they kitted me out with all the sort of wet weather gear, they tried getting the most experienced Zodiac drivers to, with a view to taking me ashore, they eventually decided it was just too risky. So I never got ashore again.
You saw it?
I saw it, yes.
Yeah.
So that was the end of my...
So was this one trip to the Antarctic in... It was 1947,
47, 48.
Was that a springboard for a career for you?
Not really, no. What did I do? I came back from... I'd been running the measurements at Stanley, and when that finished, I came back to the UK and back to the government department. Before I went down, I was a very humble assistant, grade three, which was basically, it wasn't a scientific post at all. It was basically a A-level posting. Anyway, when they wanted me to go down to Stanley, I said, it's all very well, I don't mind going down to Stanley, but it's an assistant two post, and unless you're going to make me raise me to an assistant two grade, I'm not going. So they agreed to do that. But the day I got back to England, they promptly reverted me to assistant three. So I said, well, you can keep your job.
Oh, I see.
So I found myself another job, which actually was with the Corporation of Trinity House, looking at radio for lighthouses. And then after that, I went and worked for Rake. It wasn't Rake at that time, it was Vickers Research. I don't remember doing anything very useful there. In fact, one reason I left it, because I felt the work I was doing there, if someone came to me and said, what's the value of what you're doing? I felt I was on a loser. I couldn't really...
You're struggling for an answer.
I couldn't really... It was looking at surveying equipment. Telerometers had really just been invented. And they were sort of making noise that I should develop the equivalent of it. I didn't see any point when there was a perfectly good equipment already. I didn't feel it was a worthwhile job, so I pulled out of it and went to Vickers Research. I certainly went to Vickers Research.
Were you working mainly in the radio field?
Sure. Yes, in the electronics field anyway.
And that summer in the Antarctic, it's quite crystal clear in your memories. That must have been important to you.
Oh, it was, yes. It was, unique sort of experience, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and Well, I was very pleased to have the opportunity of going back in 2005 to see it again, and I'd quite cheerfully go down again.